in Lafayette Parish. I was brought up in Doosan. And I left 1941 to go to the service. I was 21 years old. I left home with $21 in my pocket to go make $21 a month. After I was in the service about 90 days, I made corporal on the field. And I stayed corporal until I got in Alaska. A sergeant. They made me sergeant when I got in Alaska. Then me and the mess sergeant, we had a falling out for food. They reduced me to $21 a month. And they shipped the sergeant back to the United States. That's the reason I had a chance to get in the kitchen. Because the captain asked me if I could do better than him. I said, well, it wouldn't be hard to do better than him. He said, because when somebody tell you you have a group out, save food for those people. But when I came back with my group, the man opened a can of pork and bean and a can of Vienna sausages and pour it on the musket just like that with no bread, no nothing, not even heat it, and expect for me to take that. So that's the reason. You could go to whoever you want. So I went to the captain with that. And in my experience in the service, I'll be frank with you. Just like my friend said a while ago, I wouldn't pay $1 million to see it over again. But it was a great experience to me. I went to the service with very little education, and I made a great accomplishment while I was in the service through my cooking. I came back to Lafayette. I was the top chef in Lafayette. Long as I work here, I work in the kitchen for 44 years. I'm a father of 5 children, which my baby's 29 years old. So they all grown, they're on their own, and I got a little retirement check, and I'm living pretty good now.
Okay, with your kids, the occupations of
the occupation of the children. My oldest one is a radiology diagnoser. The second one is a surgeon. My third child, he refused to be a lawyer. He have a reggae band now. My daughter married a professional baseball player. My baby son married a registered nurse. And I have 5 grandchildren, 1 granddaughter and 4 granddaughters. And they range. My grandson is 20, my granddaughter 16. And the rest of them from 4 to 2.
Okay. You say you've been married?
46 years I've been married to the same lady. Her name is B. Bruce R.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Let me see. The oldest son is 45 years old. As I told you, the baby was 29. They're all ranching between that and... I tried to send them all to school, but at that time, some of them didn't have a chance. They didn't want to finish school. So my baby son back in school tried to finish his education. He got a year left to finish college, and all the rest of them went to college. I sent all 5 of them to college.
Okay. What's the major of your youngest son?
He's in business.
Okay. Okay. Now...
My name is Anthony Mouton. I was born in Lafayette, Louisiana, June 13, 1922. I went into the service on June the 2nd, 1941, in Camp Livingston, Louisiana. And it took quite a bit of adjusting for me because I had never been away from home and from my mother in so long, and I couldn't get used to it, being on my own. but I weathered the storm, so to speak. I got to be a company recreational non-commissioned officer. They put me in charge of the day room. I spoke to the company commander about getting 26 pigeonholes from A to Z. And instead of the guys having to come for mail call every day, I would go to headquarters and pick up the mail and bring it in and sort it out like you do in the post office and put them in the pigeonholes. And the guys just had to come into the day room and ask, do you have mail for John Doe or so and so and so. And that's what I did until we got ready to go overseas, or rather go to the Yukon to work on the Alaska Highway. They transferred me to headquarters company and put me with the regimental supply. I stayed with regimental supply all my time overseas. I taught myself how to type through a correspondence course, and I got to be a clerk typist in the regimental supply office. Then I stayed over there until we came back to the state, and they transferred me to Port Huachuca, Arizona, where I took up teletype, and I got to in the Signal Corps as a teletype operator, and stayed there until I was discharged. And I came back and went to California to play professional baseball because I had played professional. I had played baseball in the Army and made the post all-star team on the island. So I went to California to play in the AAA League, and I stayed there a couple of years and had a little business going until my mother died back in Louisiana. So I came back home, and since I was the baby of the family and my brothers and sisters said I was too far away from home, why don't I move back and come on to Houston, Texas, where my brother lived, to go to school. So I went back to California and sold my little business and came on back and went to Texas Southern University in Houston. Went there for 4 years, and I moonlighted waiting table and bartending all the while I was in school. When I got out of school, I went into the insurance business with a big insurance company in Houston, and I stayed there until I retired. Now I'm presently retired, and I moved back to Lafayette.
Okay, you want to share maybe some of your experiences while you were working on the Alcan, some of the memorable things that you can remember? How it was to work out there, that type of weather,
Very, very cold, and being from the South, I had to get adjusted to that pretty quick, too. I remember when we were in Skagway, when we were living in tents, a few of us went up a mountain right across from the area where we were, and we climbed the top of this mountain. And when we got ready to come back down, I couldn't get back down. We had to come to a place where you had to jump down, and it looked like if I would jump, I would keep rolling and roll all the way back down. I mean, it was way down there, and I could look down there, and I could see our camp, and the tents looked like they were about as big as my fist. And I stayed there, and you know, there were bears and everything up there, man. So it started getting dark, and I just had to take a chance, and Lord, and I jumped, and I was so afraid. I just knew that was the end, but I wasn't going to stay up there, and I jumped, and I made it. Now, that was something that I'll never forget. But I met some people, some friends of mine, while I was there that really elevated my thinking about myself as a person. The guy's name was Paul Sandifer. He had a college degree, went to North Carolina A&T. He was from New York. His sister was a judge, and his brother was a judge in New York City. And I used to see so many words that I didn't know what they meant. And I would go and talk to him. I said, Paul, what does the incidentally mean, or something like that? He would say, well, that means like if you would say, oh, by the way. Everything I'd go to ask him, he always would answer me. And he really educated me. And then he told me, he says, I would retain everything he taught me. And he told me, he says, when you get out of the service, you ought to go to school. He said, because you've got a good mind and you retain everything that's of interest to you. He said, you ought to go to school. And I remember, I said, I'll never forget that. And I couldn't wait when I got out to get a chance to go to school. And I just wish I could find him now to tell him what I did with my life and how much an impact he made on my life. He made me feel like, hey, I do have something to contribute to humanity, you know. And that's one guy I'll never forget. And I'm glad I went in the Army because I got a chance to meet him. That's just what kind of impression he made on me. Paul Sandifer. You remember him, don't you, Joe?
Oh, yeah.
Boy, he was a great guy. That and the fact that I took it upon myself to practice and learn how to type and learn how to teletype on my own, just with a book, you know. And I had that kind of, I guess, mother wit, you might call it, to go down and do that. And all this was because Paul Sandifer told me, you got it. You can do this, man. You know? And I didn't think too much of myself at first. Of course, I was young, you know, I didn't have a father to really guide me when I was coming up. I had older brothers, you know, but my father left when I was a kid. But this guy took an interest in me and guided me the right way. And that's, I'll never forget that. That's one thing I'll never forget.
Okay, Francis, your turn.
Paul W. Francis, born in Lafayette, August 17, 1922. Went into the service in 41, April 41, to camp, first to Camp Shelby, Mississippi, then from there to Alexandria, what they call Camp Livingston. Got all my training there. Then left from there and went to Skagway, Alaska. And actually, my experience from the service, long as I wasn't in the state, all I ever made was a PFC because I couldn't kiss the officers around. They wanted to promote me because that's what they used to try every day, to promote me, because they said, because since you say you're going to become a regular Army, we'll advance you. But I couldn't kiss on them. You know, I couldn't go around and hug them and kiss on them. So when they seen that they couldn't get me in their fold, so they say, well, we're just going to, well, first class, when you're a PFC first class, you want all the top notches. You're better than a master sergeant. Your work's supposed to be better. In anything you do, you're supposed to be sharp all the time, which I was. So all of my good experience was that, well, as long as I was up at Camp Livingston, everything was easy going. Because anytime I wanted to go someplace, even though we had one of the top sergeant, he was sort of a mean. But if I wanted to go, I say, Sergeant, I'm going to some place. Go. He didn't stop me because he knew if he went, I could cover up for him. So we got along really good. But once we got in Skagway, Alaska, the whole ball game changed. So actually, all I had in the service probably was about a year of good experience, because if I would have stayed in the state, I would have made it a real career. I would have went as high as I could have been. I would have been able to go. And but when we got over there, and they start, we was right. That was about a half of a mile from the little town of Skagway, and we, and every afternoon, they because we were just waiting to go on the Alcan Highway, so we didn't have anything to do but just polish our rifle, polish the equipment, and just hang around. So, but in the afternoon they'll let everybody go and we'll go to the movie. And like I say, now it's gonna be all bad experience now. You know?
You mean while you were working on the Alcan?
Yeah, you know. So we used to go to that movie up up in Skagway, and they didn't have no blacks there. We was the only blacks there, and all the native was all white. And the officers didn't care for us to go over there and mix with them at all. So then they start telling the people that we had tails. We actually had, so they start telling we had tails. So some of the guys would go out on the street and they'd say, "Oh, you're a monkey, you got a tail, you got a tail." So one guy, to show them that he didn't have no tail, he pulled his clothes down and showed them his rear end. He said, "Now, do I have a tail?" "No." So they went to find out. So he asked him, "Who told you all that?" The officers was passing.
You mean the white officers?
The white officers. Because that the only black officers they had in 40, in the 40s when we went into service, the SS was all over. Whether it was in Europe or not, it was only the chapel. All the rest was white. All the, yeah, you see. And so after they seen that, They still couldn't convince themselves. They figured that we still was an animal. That's how they had washed or brainwashed those people already. So what they did, the white officers held a town meeting. So with all the head of a Skagway, for not us to go to the movie while the citizen was up there. The native, so they'll keep us there. So we could go see a movie. They'll open up the movie house at 10 o'clock in the morning, to 2, and that was it.
That's the only time the blacks could go to
school. That's right. That's right. That's all. Then after that, then this was for all the native to go, but the blacks couldn't go. After that, that's when I really started getting disgusted with the service then. You know, but I wouldn't go. So the guys thought boycott. They wouldn't go at all. Only those kids, you know, behind, you know, those guys, you know. But they certainly couldn't open up a movie house for half a dozen guys because they wouldn't make no money. You know. So when we moved out of there, that's when we went on the Alcan Highway then, because we started in Carcross. You see. My company was a company B, where it was a company we used to do the impossible. We was the spearhead. You know, we used to move. We always was up front, no matter what was going on. Company B was up front. We supposed to have all the know-how in doing that. So we was the first one up in Carcross to start setting up, to start on the road. And that's when they really start getting chicken, those officers, you know. If they had stuff to eat, like meat, when the meat was coming from the state, when we started getting meat probably about 6 months after we got there, they'll keep the meat for themselves. So that's why I was saying a few minutes ago, we used to go out and do our own hunting, own fishing, and kill our own game so we could have meat to eat. And one time, they sent some horse meat up there for us to eat. So nobody ate the horse meat, you see. Because how we found out it was horse meat, the guy that brought the meat, he left the tag on the meat.
So the tag was on the meat stating that it was horse meat.
Yeah, it was horse meat. So you see, if they would have took the tag off, well, we would have ate the meat. But they cooked the meat, but so this guy, after it was all done, he said, "You guys gonna have horse meat for tonight." So nobody ate the meat. So they had to throw all the meat away. They had about 300-400 pounds of meat there. So they lost all that. So we say, "Well, we're gonna do our own hunting." So they'll get, you see, they wouldn't issue you know, ammunition.
But you did, you had the rifles.
You had the rifle.
But no ammunition.
No ammunition. So if you had to go, if you wanted to go hunt, you had to go check out your ammunition. And you had to bring say they give you 5 shells. You had to bring those 5 cartridges back.
The empty cartridges.
That's right. Yeah. to show that you had used them. See, that's the only way you could get it. So, me, I usually, I used to hunt just, I had the rifle, but I used to hunt just a small game, you know, birds, you know, like your grouse and rabbits, things like that. I wouldn't try to hunt the moose. In case I would see one, I would have shot them. But I used to hunt just the small stuff. Then that's when we continue going on that road till we was putting up a bridge a little before the winter came. A little before the winter came, we had to cross a creek about 50 feet wide. And I say to myself, I say, if I ever could get out of here, this is it. I ain't coming back. No kind of way. So the weather had dropped that particular morning to 20 degrees below zero. And they had us working, putting the strings across so we could put the bridge up. We started that morning, early part, by 8 that morning. We worked 36 hours.
Without any sleep or rest?
Without any sleep or rest. In that water to cross the creek. So when we went back to the tents.
Well, when you would get in the water, suppose you didn't want to get in the water. What happened after you came out of the water with it being 20 below?
Well, they had a fire built for you, but you could, it wouldn't warm you up, you know, because the wind was blowing, snowing out there and everything. So you just, just keep turning your back, you know, like you was roasting yourself.
Turning yourself over.
Yeah, you know, to try to stay warm. But the officer, he never would get in the water. Mm. You see, he would just stay right on dry ground. Just tell, hey, get in there, do that. You see, he lets you probably get out the water every now and then for about 5 or 10 minutes, you know. But you wouldn't stay no half hour or hour out there.
Well, did anybody ever, from your knowledge, get frostbitten? Ever die?
I knew a guy got so frostbitten that had to cut his... That's when we was making our move from Donison Creek back to Skagway. And we had to walk. We walked 30 miles that night. The only trucks that was available was a white outfit was down the road from us.
Civilian outfit.
Huh?
The civilian outfit they had?
No. These was white guys.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they had so long. They got there a little before the winter hit. Uh-huh. And they had all those big trucks there. So, and we start moving. Walking. Just walking. We wasn't. they say, well, you guys have to walk out of here. That's when the weather hadn't dropped to 40 below zero. I'll never forget that. This fellow by the name of Sergeant, he was the sergeant at the mess hall. He was walking along too. So when we got to that white outfit where all those truck was, he hardly could walk because his foot was aching, and he said he couldn't feel anything. So he went next to the fire. When he went to the fire, because he hadn't supposed to go by the heater, but he didn't know. He went straight by that heater, and his foot just swelled up. They had to cut the boots off of him. So they cut the boots off of him. So then one of the officers was up in there from that white outfit. He came in, and he looked at him. He said, I can't do nothing for you, man, because I'm not over you, you know. But you have to. You could stay here until some of your officers come through. He said, because they're gonna have to take you to the hospital. He said, because your foot is bad. His foot had just done open up like a rotten tomato. So they took him to Fairbanks. Took him to Fairbanks. Then later on, we heard that they cut half of one foot off, and the other one they took about three toes off. Then they sent him back to Seattle. Now, that's when I was complaining about my feet. But I guess they say, oh, shoot. He's a private first class. He's not supposed to complain. So that's when he was talking about a Chukwu Barrage, mm-hmm. or right outside of a Skagway, across the bay at least. And they start making us working to unload some barges, 60 degrees below zero. And that's the first two time I went in the water to get some of the boxes. It didn't bother me. Hey, you're still warm a little. You know, you could move around. But after I started going back and forth, every time I'd come out the water, I was a solid piece of ice. And we didn't have nothing to heat us with out there. No fire, you know, nothing. You go get some more stuff, you come back out the water, you're another solid piece of ice. He was walking like he was a Frankenstein. So, and then I told that officer, I say, my feet is really bothering me. He said, get back out there. It's okay. Go back out there. So that night, as the degree, it was falling more and more, we couldn't go back in the water anymore because the thing was just a solid, that whole bay was a solid piece of ice.
So the froze over.
Yeah, so the barge had to stay out there. So nobody could go out there. So when I went back to the barrack, I told, I had one kid there by the name of Gentry, he died. He was from New Orleans, he was a medic, so I told him. So he said, you better just take care of your feet. He said, probably they frostbite your toes. Because those little toes were just as, well, they was numb. I couldn't feel a doggone thing on them. Both little toes. So by that time, that's when they said they weren't going to do nothing about those barges because then they was going to have to wait until spring because they couldn't go back out there. So that's when they took us to Adak, Alaska. But then they put us on that ship to go to Adak. It was old World War I. We was loaded with everything you could name. It was loaded down. All those big houses was on there. You know, everything was on there, loaded down. Then that Navy captain said, well, he said, everybody gonna have to get down below. Nobody on top because they had a Japanese submarine up in the area following us. Because it followed us, it was up in the Gulf of Alaska for 2 days. And for 2 days, that Gulf was so rough. Listen, that Gulf was so rough that Captain had been sailing for 30-some years, and he was seasick. The sailors was seasick. So what they did, because there was all up in those Turk way up on top, you see, the sailors. What they did, they got us, most of the guy from Company B, and took you on the ship and strap you in the gun turret. How are you going to see a submarine at night now? You know, but you was out there in the gun turret, tied. They'll tie you in there. You see, they didn't put me in the gun turret. They put me on one side of the boat with a 50 caliber. But I was tied, I was strapped against the wall of the boat. See, because the water was so rough, it was stripping the metal from the inside of the walls. You know, like all the stuff, like beads was all, probably been in a ship. Where all the beads is in a big line, they're all screwed, at least well to the floor. It was ripping that off, just like tan paper, the water, so rough. And it did that for 2 days, night and day. It wasn't letting up. You couldn't eat. It was so rough. When you went to get your food, it would just fly out of your hand. You know, it was just so. I stayed. I told that sergeant, I said, look, I say, if they pass like some oranges around, which they had a lot of oranges on, I say, bring me one out. I say, I'm going to just stay outside and tie it down. I say, I'm going to take my chance there. you know, because, hey, where are you going to go? So after we got to ADAC, it was the same thing, just working, making wells, digging wells for water for us to drink, digging it yourself with a pick and a shovel.
How far did you have to go down?
30 feet.
Was any of the ground frozen?
Frozen, all the way down. So you had to go 30 feet before you could hit soft ground. When you hit the sand, it's all from the ashes from the volcano that had erupted years ago. Mm-hmm. Then you know you was pretty close to the water. And we did, I guess I dug about 25 of those wells for water. See, because the white guys, they didn't dig no wells. Just the engineer. Even they had engineers out there. The white engineers didn't dig no well. All they was doing them was guarding us. But we was the workhorse for them. You see.
Well, your experiences on the Alcan, while building the road, how were you treated then? What were the accommodations like, the living accommodations? Or were you allowed to maybe go into town? Or did you have any liberties?
No, no liberty. None. No, I never seen a liberty on the Alcan Highway. They wouldn't let you go. They wouldn't let you go nowhere. You work. We used to work 7 days a week. See, that's it. You didn't go nowhere. The only recreation you had, if you could call it recreation, was in the evening. Guys used to be out there talking all that crazy talk.
Singing.
And playing cards or dominoes, things like that. But otherwise, it was no recreation. Nobody had that. Or officer wanted to see you, he'll come and send a sergeant and have you to go to his tent. So, well, tomorrow you get so and so, this guy and that guy, you go out and kill some grass or something like that. You know. But otherwise, you didn't have no recreation. Oh, but the only recreation probably a guy could say he had, when they says take you out on that big lake that had froze over, they'll take you out there and train you on that lake. Probably was about 35 or 40 below zero on that lake, but you'd be running back and forward, you see, and screaming and hollering. From that time, that's another experience I had on that lake. You had all that wrap around your nose. You had your nose wrapped up with the cap for protection. My nose got so cold, it turned gray. It was freezing, you see. It was freezing. So this captain here, he stayed with us about 3 weeks. He stayed with us 3 weeks, and he was close to the guy. For 3 weeks, that guy was really close to the men. He come up to me and say, gee, man, he say, can you feel your nose? I say, all I could feel is a stinging, like a bee stinging you. He say, it's gray. He say, your nose freezing. He say, go up to your, we had a big tent out there where we used to eat. He said, they got fire up in there. He said, stay in the back of it. He said, as your nose get defrost, you're going to feel more tinging in it. And he said, just keep gradually. He said, and I'll be over there, and I'll check it. Now, that guy was a man. But he didn't stay with us but 3 weeks. They didn't want him. You see, because he was too close to the soldiers, you see. I don't know where. They got him out of there. I don't know where that fellow went. Nobody knew he was going. When we found out that somebody else was in his place, a hardcore southerner. I guess he must have come out of Alabama somewhere or the Delta, Mississippi. He was a tough man. He didn't care for nothing. He didn't care for a doggone thing. Then from there, that's when we went At least we come back to the state at Fort Lewis, Washington. When we got to Fort Lewis, Washington, I was thinking that that the officers was tough on the Alcan Highway. There was worse in Fort Lewis, Washington.
You mean on the black soldiers?
Oh yeah. Listen, I never forget that. My temperature was 105. My Thompson, I couldn't hardly talk. You could see the Thompsons like this. And I went to the captain, I said, Captain Campbell, I said, I have to go to the hospital. I said, I can't hold all this water. The only time you went Company B, the only time those soldiers went to the dispensary was at night.
Why at night? Why they want
to? Because they had to do the work
during
the daytime. They didn't want nobody to say it was gold breaking, or nobody to say, "Hey, I'm gonna." So, like, you go to the dispensary. Well, the doctor might say, "Well, or take a day off, you know, stay in your tent for a day, take this medicine." They used to go only at night. I was so bad, and so he said, "Well, okay," he say, "you go," he say, "but if he said, but I'm gonna check on you." So I went, and the doctor over there said, "I'm gonna put you in the hospital." They put me in the hospital one night. 2 days later, we had to go for some mountain training around Olympia, Washington. They moved the whole company over there. On the third day, that officer was there to get me out of the hospital. That's right. Had them to discharge me.
So you could go along with the company.
That's right. That's right. That's right. And I still wasn't well.
Okay, now, what was your duty or career while you were in the Army there, working on the Alcan?
Well, most of it was demolition and carpentry. You know, I used to do what they call heavy carpentry. I wouldn't do, was build a road and bridges. That's all I ever did. No, nothing else, man.
Okay. I want to tell you something else. I remember for Christmas in 1942, we were there. It was 70 in the Yukon, 70 degrees below zero. We were living in a tent, and we would chop firewood. We had little wood heaters there to keep us warm. And I'll never forget this as long as I live, that Christmas Day. It was four of us in our tent. We had Vienna sausage and mashed potatoes and corned beef hash. And we had a little phonograph that you wind up. And we had one record, I'll never forget it. It was Helen Forrest singing Serenade in Blue. And I can hear it now. Click, click. When I hear that Serenade in Blue, we played that all day long and talked about home. Talked about home. I will never, never forget that. It was me and a guy by the name of Lockwood from Baltimore, and Ringo and Valentine, Sergeant Valentine, sitting there. And it was 70 degrees below zero. If we'd go outside for 5 minutes, your eyebrows and your eyelashes and the hairs in your nose would get frost from the vapors from your breath. That's one experience I wanted to share with you. Okay. But I'll tell you one thing.
Right there in Fort Lewis, Washington, they had us on that mountain for that mountain training, sleeping in pup tent, rain all the time we was up there. So that's all it was done. And you was out there, it was in the wintertime. Soon morning came. You wasn't dry. You stay wet. The water would come into the little tent. No matter how well you had it barricaded with mud, dirt around there, the water would come in. The water started coming off that mountain. You swear it was a flood. It would just go come right straight in. And you couldn't say, "I'm going to stand up outside." Because his tent, the officer's tent, was, all our tent was on the side. His tent was in the middle at the end. if you come out there say it's raining too much, I'm going to stand outside because I don't want that dirt, that mud to come in on me. Get back in there. That's right. So, and that's what's, that's going to never leave my mind. When I saw another kid by the name of Kirkwood, he come out of Mississippi. When the officer told him, he went to the officer and say, I have to go to, he went, because we was on training on that mountainside, running and doing whatever we had to do. He told the officer, he said, could I go to the doctor before nightfall? He said, no. He said, what, you said, what wrong? He said, I'm spitting up my tonsil. His tonsil got so bad, he spit a piece of his tonsil. And he still didn't go. We had 3 days there on that mountain left. He stayed right there with us. Right there. And finally, one day, we moved to another site after we came back from the mountain side. And we moved some other place. We're going to take some training, like jungle training. And so my Townsend got bad on me again. So I told that officer about it. He said, you're not going nowhere. You're not going. I said, then we didn't have no medic with us at all. Once you ate your food, there wasn't a law to give you nothing at the mess hall. I wanted some salt to gargle with. So I couldn't get no salt. So I was talking to one fellow by the name of Samuel Cotton. He might be dead now, him, because he was really a rotted kid.
He didn't come around here all the time.
So he came off from one of those big plantations. He said, look, if you want some salt, he said, take your urine and gargle with it. Mm. I never thought of that. Which I had never thought of it. I said, who told you about that? He said, well, he said, my grandfather. You know, back in those days, there was on those plantations, no doctor for them to go to. So he said he would take his urine and gargle his throat with when he had sore throat. Mm-hmm. I took my urine, gargled my throat with it. Mm. Every day or twice a day. When I went to really get a lot of urine come up, I just put, it's from your own body. Mm. It's not poison, it's from your own body. So I would gargle my throat with it. And finally, my tonsils just went down. And they stayed down afterward. I didn't have my tonsils out until I went to San Francisco.
Okay. Now, what